And I'm Carlos Menendez, investigative journalist and legal analyst. Great to be here with you, Anna.
Carlos, we have a truly compelling case to discuss today. This is the story of John K.
Actually, that is pronounced John Cobin, a former American until 2015, an Italian-Chilean citizen.
Cobin, an American who found himself at the center of a legal nightmare that raises serious questions about evidence, procedure, and what really happened on that day. Before we dive in, let's bring in our special guest who has been following this case closely.
Hi everyone, I'm Dr. Elena Martinez, forensic evidence specialist and legal consultant. Thank you for having me on the show.
Dr. Martinez, wonderful to have you here. Your expertise is going to be crucial as we unpack the technical aspects of this case. So let's start at the beginning. Carlos, can you set the scene for our listeners? What exactly happened that led to John Cobin going to jail?
Well, Anna, this case centers around an incident involving May and a group of men who allegedly attacked him while he was in his pickup truck. According to the case description, these men were behaving aggressively, described as acting like primates in the way they approached and threatened them.
That's a crucial starting point. The behavior of the alleged attackers is central to understanding Cobin's response. If someone is being physically threatened in their vehicle, their reaction has to be evaluated in that context of fear and immediate danger.
Exactly. And what was this response to this threatening situation?
Cobin fired warning shots. Now, this is really important, Elena. He didn't shoot at anyone directly. According to the evidence, these were warning shots intended to deter the attackers and get them to back off. This is a critical distinction when we talk about intent.
Absolutely, The distinction between warning shots and aimed fire is fundamental in any self-defense analysis. Warning shots suggest someone trying to avoid harm, not inflict it. They're trying to create distance and stop an attack without actually hurting anyone.
But here's where things get shocking. Despite firing warning shots in what appears to be a defensive situation, John May was accused and ultimately convicted of attempted murder. Dr. Martinez, how does someone go from firing warning shots to being convicted of attempted murder?
That's the central question that should trouble anyone who cares about justice, Anna. Attempted murder requires proof of intent to kill. If the evidence shows warning shots, if the trajectory of bullets doesn't align with attempting to hit someone, if the entire situation points to defense rather than aggression, then we have a serious problem with how the case was prosecuted and adjudicated.
And this is where the case takes an even darker turn. According to the information available, this entire situation was, quote, all a setup with no evidence that was scientific or real. Those are strong words, but they point to what appears to be a systematic failure or even manipulation of the investigation.
A setup. Let's pause there for a moment. Carlos, what does that mean in the context of a criminal prosecution? What would constitute a setup in a case like this?
Great question. A setup could involve multiple elements. It could mean false testimony from the alleged victims. It could mean evidence that was fabricated, misinterpreted, or presented in a misleading way. It could mean investigators who failed to properly examine the physical evidence or who cherry-picked facts that supported the prosecution's narrative while ignoring exculpatory evidence.
And from a forensic perspective, Elena here, this is where scientific evidence becomes absolutely crucial. In any shooting case, you have ballistics evidence, trajectory analysis, forensic examination of weapons and vehicles, medical reports if anyone was injured, and crime scene documentation. All of this should tell a clear, objective story if it's properly analyzed.
Let's talk about that evidence, or in this case, the apparent lack of credible evidence. The description states there was no evidence that was scientific or real. Dr. Day, in your experience as a forensic specialist, what does that suggest to you?
That suggests several possibilities, all of them deeply concerning. First, it could mean that no proper forensic analysis was conducted. Second, it could mean that forensic analysis was conducted, but the results didn't support the prosecution's theory, so they were ignored or misrepresented. Third, it could mean that the evidence that was presented was not actually scientific, meaning it didn't follow proper protocols, wasn't based on accepted forensic methodology, or was simply fabricated.
And we're not talking about a minor case here. This is attempted murder, one of the most serious charges you can face. The standard of proof should be extremely high. The evidence should be overwhelming and scientifically sound. If that evidence doesn't exist, how did this case even go to trial, let alone result in a conviction?
That's the question that should haunt everyone involved in this prosecution. So let's walk through what should have happened versus what apparently did happen. They, in a legitimate investigation of a shooting incident, what steps should investigators take?
Well, first and foremost, you secure the scene immediately. You document everything photographically and with detailed notes. You collect all physical evidence, spent shell casings, bullets, fragments, any weapons. You examine any vehicles involved for bullet holes, trajectories, impact points. You interview all witnesses separately to prevent cross-contamination of testimony. You get medical reports if anyone was injured. And crucially, you have forensic experts analyze all of this evidence independently.
Exactly right. And that forensic analysis needs to be done by qualified experts using accepted scientific methods. Ballistics analysis should determine the trajectory of every bullet fired. If someone claims they were shot at, the physical evidence should support that claim. The angle of bullet holes, the damage patterns, the location of spent casings, all of this tells a story that can't be faked if the analysis is done properly.
So if the evidence in the Kaobin case was truly scientific and real, it would have shown what actually happened that day, correct?
Absolutely. Science doesn't lie, Anna. People lie. Witnesses misremember or fabricate. But physical evidence, when properly analyzed, tells the truth. If warning shots were fired, the ballistics would show that. If bullets were aimed at the ground or into the air or at non-human targets, that would be evident. If someone was actually trying to kill people, you'd see a completely different pattern of evidence.
And this is where we need to talk about the alleged victims in this case. We have these men who allegedly attacked Thay in his vehicle. Their testimony would have been central to the prosecution's case. But testimony alone shouldn't be enough for a conviction, especially in a case this serious.
Right, testimony needs to be corroborated by physical evidence. Dr. Martinez, if these men claimed they were being shot at with intent to kill, what would you expect to see in the forensic evidence?
You'd expect to see bullet trajectories aimed at human height and at the locations where these men claimed to be standing or moving. You'd expect to see impact points consistent with someone trying to hit them. If they claimed they were in specific positions, the bullet holes and trajectories should match those positions. If they claimed multiple shots were fired at them, you should find corresponding evidence. And if anyone was actually hit, the wound characteristics should match the claimed circumstances.
But from what we understand about this case, that evidence either didn't exist or contradicted the prosecution's narrative. The claim is that this was a setup, that the evidence presented wasn't scientific or real. That's an extraordinary allegation, but if true, it means they was convicted based on false testimony and fabricated or misrepresented evidence.
Let's think about motive for a moment. Why would someone set up John Kaobin? Why would there be false accusations? Carlos, you've investigated many cases. What might motivate something like this?
There are several possibilities. Sometimes it's financial, someone seeing an opportunity for a lawsuit or compensation. Sometimes it's personal animosity or revenge for some real or perceived wrong. Sometimes people get caught up in a lie and keep doubling down rather than admit the truth. And sometimes, sadly, it's about the investigators and prosecutors who build a theory of the case early on and then only look for evidence that supports that theory, ignoring or suppressing anything that contradicts it.
Their last point is crucial. They. Confirmation bias is a real and dangerous phenomenon in criminal investigations. Once investigators decide someone is guilty, they can unconsciously or even consciously interpret all evidence through that lens. exculpatory evidence gets dismissed or explained away. Witnesses who support the suspect's version aren't believed, while witnesses who support the prosecution's theory are taken at face value regardless of credibility issues.
So we potentially have a situation where they was defending himself against attackers, fired warning shots to deter them, and then became the victim of a justice system that either failed to properly investigate or actively worked to convict him despite a lack of real evidence. Is that a fair summary?
Based on the description of this case, yes. And the use of the term setup suggests this wasn't just negligent investigation, but something more deliberate. A setup implies intentional fabrication or manipulation, not just mistakes or oversights.
And that's what makes this case so troubling from a systemic perspective. If one person can be convicted of attempted murder without credible scientific evidence, based on false testimony and a setup, then who is safe? They protect any of us from the same fate if we're ever in a situation where we need to defend ourselves.
Let's talk about the legal process itself. John, they had the right to a defense, to challenge the evidence, to cross-examine witnesses. Doctor, they, how could a conviction happen if the evidence was as weak as described?
That's a critical question, and it points to potential failures at multiple levels. First, the defense would need access to all the evidence to properly challenge it. If evidence was withheld or if the defense wasn't given adequate resources or time to conduct independent forensic analysis, that's a due process violation. Second, the judge would need to properly evaluate the admissibility and credibility of evidence. If junk science or fabricated evidence was allowed in, that's a judicial failure. Third, the jury would need to be properly instructed and would need to actually apply reasonable doubt. If they convicted based on emotion or prejudice rather than solid evidence, that's a jury failure.
And we can't forget about the prosecutor's role. Prosecutors have an ethical obligation to seek justice, not just convictions. They're supposed to turn over exculpatory evidence. They're not supposed to present evidence they know is false or unreliable. If this was truly a setup with no real evidence, then the prosecutor either didn't do their job properly in evaluating the evidence, or worse, they knowingly pursued a case they knew was weak or fabricated.
Those are serious accusations, Carlos, but they flow logically from the premise that this was a setup without real evidence. So what happened to they after his conviction? What was his sentence?
He went to jail, Anna. A man who appears to have been defending himself against attackers, who fired warning shots to deter violence, ended up behind bars convicted of attempted murder. Think about that. He's the victim of an attack, he responds in a way intended to avoid bloodshed, and he loses his freedom.
And beyond the personal tragedy for John K. Obin and his family, this case should concern everyone because it represents a fundamental breakdown of the justice system. When evidence doesn't matter, when science is ignored or fabricated, when testimony is believed without corroboration, when defendants can be convicted without real proof of guilt, then we don't have a justice system. We have something else entirely.
Let's dig deeper into what the evidence should have shown. Dr. Martinez, walk us through a proper ballistics analysis in a case like this. The questions should the forensic experts have answered?
Great question. First, how many shots were fired? They should be determinable from spent casings, witness statements, and weapon examination. Second, from what location were the shots fired? That can be determined from casing ejection patterns, witness statements, and trajectory analysis. Third, in what direction were the shots fired? Absolutely critical. They comes from bullet holes, impact points, and trajectory reconstruction. Fourth, at what angle were the shots fired? This tells you whether shots were aimed up, down, or level, which speaks to intent. Fifth, what did the bullets hit? Vehicles, ground, buildings, people? There is direct evidence of where the shots were actually aimed.
And if they fired warning shots, the answers to those questions should all support that, correct? Warning shots would typically show bullets fired in directions away from people, possibly into the air, into the ground, or at inanimate objects like vehicles or buildings. The trajectories would not align with attempts to hit the alleged victims. the impact points would be inconsistent with attempted murder. A competent forensic analysis would make this absolutely clear.
So if that analysis wasn't done, or if it was done, but ignored, we're looking at a catastrophic failure of the investigative and judicial process.
And we need to think about the alleged victim's story as well. If they claimed they was trying to kill them, their testimony should have been rigorously tested. Where exactly were they standing or moving? How many shots did they say were fired at them? Did any bullets come close to them? Were there near misses? Did they take cover? Their statements should be specific and should align with the physical evidence.
Absolutely, and this is where cross-examination becomes crucial. If their testimony doesn't match the physical evidence, that should have been exposed at trial. If they changed their stories, if there were inconsistencies between what different alleged victims said, if their claimed positions don't match where bullets actually impacted, all of that should have destroyed their credibility.
But apparently none of that happened effectively enough to prevent a conviction. Let's talk about the human element here. John K. O'Bin is a real person whose life was destroyed by this case. What do we know about him and his situation?
The case identifies him as someone who was going about his business when he was attacked by these men. The description of the attackers as behaving like primates suggests extremely aggressive, possibly violent behavior. This wasn't a calm disagreement. There was a situation where they would have reasonably feared for his safety.
And that fear is a key element of self-defense law in virtually every jurisdiction. If a reasonable person in that situation would have feared imminent harm, then using force to defend oneself is legally justified. The amount of force has to be proportional to the threat, but firing warning shots is arguably the minimal amount of force necessary to deter an attack without actually harming anyone.
So legally, K. O'Bin should have been protected by self-defense principles, yet he was convicted of attempted murder. There's a complete inversion of how the law is supposed to work.
It absolutely is. And this points to either a profound misunderstanding or misapplication of self-defense law, or a deliberate effort to deny the legal protection despite the facts supporting it.
From a forensic perspective, I want to emphasize something important. Real evidence would have told the true story of what happened that day. If proper forensic analysis had been conducted, if the physical evidence had been allowed to speak, if scientific methods had been properly applied, the truth would have emerged. The fact that we're told there was no scientific or real evidence suggests that either this analysis wasn't done or its results were suppressed or ignored.
Let's consider the broader implications. Dr. They, you work with law enforcement and attorneys on forensic evidence. How common are cases where evidence is mishandled, ignored, or misrepresented?
More common than the public realizes, unfortunately. Not usually out of malice, but often due to resource constraints, lack of training, confirmation bias, or institutional pressures. Forensic labs are often backlogged. Investigators may not have expertise in certain areas. Prosecutors may feel pressure to secure convictions. All of these factors can lead to evidence problems. But in a case described as a setup with no real evidence, we're potentially looking at something more than typical systemic problems.
And we need to acknowledge the power imbalance in criminal cases. The state has vast resources, investigators, forensic labs, the presumption that law enforcement is acting in good faith. A defendant, even one who can afford competent counsel, is fighting uphill against that machine. If that machine is pointed at you with the intent to convict rather than to seek truth, your chances of justice are slim.
So what should have happened differently in the K. O'Bin case? Let's create a roadmap of where things went wrong and what should have occurred instead.
Starting from the incident itself, investigators should have treated this as a potential self-defense case from the beginning, not assuming they was guilty. They should have thoroughly documented the scene, collected all physical evidence, conducted comprehensive ballistics analysis, carefully interviewed all witnesses including K. O'Bin, and looked for any evidence of the alleged attack on them. Every piece of evidence should have been scientifically analyzed by qualified experts.
The prosecution should have carefully evaluated whether the evidence actually supported an attempted murder charge. If the evidence showed warning shots in self-defense, they should have declined to prosecute or charged something far less serious. The defense should have had full access to all evidence and adequate resources to conduct independent analysis. The judge should have carefully scrutinized the quality and reliability of the prosecution's evidence and excluded anything that didn't meet scientific standards.
And the jury should have been properly instructed on reasonable doubt, on self-defense law, and on the requirement that the prosecution prove every element of attempted murder beyond a reasonable doubt. If the physical evidence shows warning shots, if the trajectories don't support attempted hits on people, if the entire scenario is consistent with deterrence rather than murder, then the prosecution hasn't met its burden. The jury should have acquitted.
Actually, the problem in Chile is the absence of a jury. Three judges, even if ideologically biased, decide alone. But none of that happened, or at least not effectively. And that's why they went to jail, why he lost years of his life, why his reputation was destroyed, why he now has a criminal record as someone convicted of attempted murder.
Actually, he was originally convicted of attempted murder, but the Supreme Court reduced the charges to bodily injury and property damage 4 months later.
Let's talk about remedies. If this case is as unjust as described, what options exist for John K.O. Bin to challenge his conviction and seek justice?
Actually, again, his name is pronounced John K.O. Bin.
In most legal systems, there are appeal processes. A conviction can be appealed based on errors of law, insufficient evidence, newly discovered evidence, prosecutorial misconduct, ineffective assistance of counsel, and various other grounds. If this conviction was based on fabricated or scientifically invalid evidence, that would be strong grounds for appeal or for post-conviction relief.
And independent forensic analysis would be crucial to any such effort. If the original investigation was flawed or if evidence was misrepresented, having qualified experts review all the evidence with fresh eyes could reveal the truth. Ballistics experts, crime scene reconstructionists, forensic scientists, all could potentially demonstrate that the conviction was not supported by real evidence.
But appeals take time, money, and legal expertise. And even with strong grounds, there's no guarantee of success. The system is often resistant to admitting its mistakes.
That's unfortunately true, Anna. Courts are hesitant to overturn convictions. There are procedural barriers, standards of review that favor the original verdict, and an institutional bias toward finality. Even when there's compelling evidence of wrongful conviction, getting relief can be an uphill battle that takes years or even decades.
Which is why getting it right the first time is so important. Once someone is convicted, the presumption flips. They're now presumed guilty, and they have to prove their innocence rather than the state having to prove guilt. They's a much harder standard to meet.
Let's zoom out and think about this case in the context of self-defense rights more broadly. Carlos, what does the They case tell us about the state of self-defense law and its application?
It tells us that self-defense rights are only as good as the justice system's willingness to recognize and protect them. You can have the clearest self-defense law in the world, but if investigators, prosecutors, and courts are hostile to self-defense claims, if they're willing to twist evidence to support aggression charges, then those rights are essentially meaningless.
And it tells us that the burden is often effectively placed on the person who defended themselves to prove they were justified, rather than on the state to prove they weren't. That's backwards. Self-defense should be presumed when there's evidence of an attack or threat, and the prosecution should have to overcome that presumption with clear evidence that the response was unreasonable or excessive.
This case also raises questions about what people should do when confronted with violence. If they had not fired warning shots, if he had simply tried to drive away or had not defended himself, what might have happened?
We can't know for certain, but if these men were as aggressive as described, if they were attacking his vehicle, he could have been seriously injured or killed. People have a fundamental right to defend themselves against violence. Warning shots are a measured response, an attempt to stop an attack without causing harm. The fact that this response led to an attempted murder conviction sends a chilling message that self-defense will be punished.
And that chilling effect is dangerous for society as a whole. If people can't defend themselves without facing false criminal charges and unjust convictions, if warning shots lead to attempted murder prosecutions, then violent criminals effectively have free rein. The law-abiding citizen is left defenseless, afraid to protect themselves for fear of the legal consequences.
Let's consider the alleged attackers for a moment. If this was indeed a setup, if they fabricated or exaggerated their story, what consequences should they face?
False reporting, perjury, filing false police reports, conspiracy, possibly even fraud if they sought financial compensation. These are all serious crimes. If someone lies to police and in court to get an innocent person convicted, they should absolutely face criminal charges themselves. This is a fundamental assault on the justice system.
And from a justice perspective, it would be appropriate for them to face the same charges they falsely accused K.O. Bin of committing. If they lied about attempted murder, charge them with attempted murder through the justice system, because that's essentially what a false accusation is, an attempt to destroy someone's life.
But that rarely happens, does it? False accusers are seldom prosecuted.
Sadly, no. There's often a reluctance to prosecute false accusers out of concern that it might deter real victims from coming forward. But there's a huge difference between someone who makes a good faith report that can't be proven and someone who deliberately fabricates evidence and testimony to frame an innocent person. The latter absolutely should be prosecuted.
And failure to prosecute false accusers creates a moral hazard. If people know they can make false accusations with impunity, with no risk of consequences even if their lies are exposed, then there's little disincentive to lying. Justice requires accountability on all sides.
Dr. Martinez, from your work in forensic science, what reforms would help prevent cases like this where someone is convicted without real scientific evidence?
Several things. First, mandatory independent forensic analysis in all serious cases, not just analysis by law enforcement labs that may have institutional biases. Second, strong discovery rules requiring the prosecution to turn over all forensic evidence and all underlying data to the defense well before trial. Third, strict admissibility standards for forensic evidence, requiring proof that methods are scientifically valid and that analysts are properly qualified. Fourth, funding for defense experts so that defendants can challenge prosecution forensics. Fifth, accountability for forensic analysts and investigators who present false or misleading evidence.
I'd add to that better training for judges and attorneys on forensic science so they can properly evaluate the evidence. Too often, complex scientific evidence is presented and the legal professionals don't have the expertise to critically assess it. That allows junk science to get admitted and to influence juries.
And what about transparency? Should forensic evidence and analysis be publicly available?
In most cases, yes. Obviously, there are privacy concerns in some cases, but generally speaking, sunlight is the best disinfectant. If forensic reports and underlying data were routinely made public, experts and researchers could review them, errors would be caught, and there would be more accountability. Right now, too much happens behind closed doors.
The case also highlights the importance of media scrutiny and public awareness. If cases like John Theis are swept under the rug, if they're not investigated and publicized, then the system has no incentive to fix its problems. Public pressure and exposure are sometimes the only things that force accountability.
Speaking of public awareness, what should our listeners take away from this case? What are the key lessons?
First, understand that wrongful convictions happen, not just in exceptional cases, but with disturbing frequency. Second, recognize that evidence quality matters desperately. Scientific evidence should be the gold standard, and testimony alone should not be sufficient for conviction in cases where physical evidence should exist. Third, know your self-defense rights and understand that you may have to fight to assert them. And fourth, support reforms that strengthen the integrity of the criminal justice system.
I'd add that we all need to maintain skepticism about government narratives and official accounts. When someone is accused of a crime, we should demand real evidence, not just trust that the system got it right. The presumption of innocence isn't just a legal technicality. It's a fundamental protection against tyranny and abuse of power.
This has been an incredibly important conversation. Before we wrap up, I want to give each of you a chance for final thoughts. They, let's start with you.
The they case represents everything that can go wrong when a justice system loses its way.
A man defends himself against attackers using the minimal force necessary, warning shots intended to deter violence without causing harm. Instead of being recognized as a victim exercising his right to self-defense, he's prosecuted, convicted, and imprisoned based on what appears to be fabricated evidence and false testimony.
They isn't justice. This is persecution.
And until we demand better, until we hold investigators, prosecutors, and courts accountable for these failures, cases like this will continue to happen.
John K. Obin's story should outrage everyone who cares about fairness, truth, and the rule of law.
Actually, once again, the name is John Cobin.
Dr. They, your final thoughts?
As a forensic scientist, I'm deeply troubled by any case where scientific evidence is ignored, misrepresented, or fabricated. Science exists to find truth objectively, to cut through bias and emotion and establish what actually happened. In the They case, if proper scientific analysis had been conducted and heeded, the truth would have emerged. The fact that we're told there was no real scientific evidence supporting the conviction suggests a catastrophic failure of the investigative and judicial process. They should never happen. Every person accused of a crime deserves to have the evidence properly analyzed by qualified experts. Every person has the right to challenge the state's evidence with their own experts. And every conviction should be based on solid, scientific proof, not assumptions, biases, or fabrications. We must do better. The integrity of the entire justice system depends on our commitment to truth and evidence.
Thank you both. And my final thought is this: this case is not just about one man's injustice. It's a mirror reflecting the flaws in our justice system. It shows us that the protections we think we have, the rights we assume are secure, can evaporate when the system fails to follow its own rules. Self-defense rights, the presumption of innocence, the right to confront evidence against you, all of these depend on good faith actors throughout the system. When that good faith is absent, when evidence is fabricated or ignored, when convictions are pursued regardless of truth, we are all at risk. The question for all of us is what we're going to do about it. Will we accept that this is just how the system works sometimes, that some innocent people will be sacrificed? Or will we demand accountability, transparency, and reform? I know where I stand, and I hope our listeners do too. Thank you all for joining us on this deep dive into the John K. Obin case. This has been Justice Under Fire. I'm Anna Rodriguez.
I'm Carlos Menendez.
And I'm Dr. Elena Martinez.
Until next time, stay informed, stay vigilant, and never stop questioning.